I'll have you know the contents of that dumpster are private. You stick your nose in, you'll be violating attorney dumpster confidentiality.
I just wanted to say hello.
Oh. Hello.
All right, we're done.
You think the language in the Second Amendment is clear enough? You know, about the right to bear arms?
Of course it's clear. Every American has the right to hang a pair of bear arms on their wall. How could that possibly be misconstrued?
All right, fantastic then. Wait, you know what? Before we send this to the printer, let's take that abortion thing out.
Oh, come on. I move for a hearing on the matter.
What? You want me to have a special motion on the admissibility of the word asshole?
Well, let me have ass then. That's close enough.
What law school did you go to?
I'll agree to it, Your Honor.
You will? Why?
I don't want any interlocutory appeals.
What are you, a comedy team?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that breaks down the law behind all the news stories you care about. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hey guys, I'm Liz Dye. With me is Andrew Torres, and this is Opening Arguments, episode 751.
Hey Liz, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I am fantastic, and I am very excited.
Fantastic.
I'm really excited about this episode. We have so much on the coming horizon. We just recorded our Law and Awful movies for Michael Cohen. I mean, Michael Clayton. It's like that dude fell into a wormhole. What a weird movie. But
it was a weird movie, but it definitely Michael Cohen has definitely watched that movie a million times and knows every line.
It's something. It makes no sense. It's a law movie. Anyway, if you're a patron at the $2 and up level, you will get Law and Awful movies in the next couple of days, and you will get all the joy that is Michael Clayton. And Liz, you are super funny in this one. I have to tell you, I don't know what the secret sauce is, but it was pretty good.
I don't know. So what else is going on this week besides Ken Paxton actually got impeached?
That was amazing. We actually took a break in our recording to kind of figure out what was going on. And the Texas House voted to refer articles of impeachment out to the full Senate. Ken Paxton has to step down while the Senate tries him, which, by the way, like that'd be a good system to have in place, you know, maybe at the federal level. But in any event, that's really, really exciting. We will cover whatever happens there. And there are reports, and I have seen the draft of what is ostensibly the deal on the debt ceiling. If you're still tracking that and you want to know what that is, share out episode 748. We put a lot of work into that explainer, and it will help be good guideposts as to what's going on. And, you know, the fact that lots of folks on every side are sort of howling about it is, you know, pretty good indication. But we will break down what actually happens when, please say when and not if, but when that deal actually happens.
Yeah. Well, with that as preamble, you guys get psyched. Because in about 15 minutes, we are going to wind Andrew up and let him just rip on this amazing case out of New York where the lawyer used ChatGPT to generate fake research and even legal opinions. And it is awesome. I called Andrew up last night and I was like, no, really, you got to look at the whole docket right now. And we spent an hour cackling and shouting, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. It was beautiful. And definitely find yourself a work wife who is like into that stuff. But before we do that, we're going to take a short visit with our old pal, Peter Navarro. Who is still having the darndest time producing those government emails he's been hiding in his Proton Mail account for 2.5 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the Patreon bonus, we're going to talk about John Eastman, author of the infamous Coups for Dummies memos, who would like the Supreme Court to undo the trial court's finding that he committed a crime with his client, Donald J. Trump.
Yeah. And I will say for our non-Patreon listeners who won't get to hear the bonus that I don't think the court's going to take the case. But if they do, it will be very, very interesting to see whether Justice Thomas recuses himself, saying, as you know, there were emails from his wife Ginny in some of the stuff unsealed by the court in that case. I mean, not the crime fraud stuff, but you know, in the other messages. And perhaps more relevantly, Eastman is Thomas's former law clerk, and no judge should ever preside over a case involving one of their law clerks, right? Like, that's just that relationship is too close,
right? I mean, look, no one ever went broke betting low on Clarence Thomas's ethics, though. So, you know,
yeah, that is
don't hold your breath.
Damn sure. But Liz, why don't you get us started by reminding us how the world's foremost lay epidemiologist, statistician, and constitutional law expert got into this whole pickle in the first place?
Keep trying. Silence, or you'll be held in contempt of this court.
I have nothing but contempt for this court.
Yeah, something I wrote appears to have pissed off his lawyers. But since you and I did that research together, Andrew, it's like you have also pissed off Stan Brand and Stanley Woodward.
Well, the honor is mine, and I'm happy for the credit to go to you.
Okay, well, so to remind ourselves of the stakes here, Peter Navarro is that crank Jared Kushner kicked up by trawling Amazon's econ section for authors who hate China and love tariffs. That is literally what happened. Mm-hmm. I'm not making that up. And Navarro managed to be one of the dumbest figures in the Trump administration. Although, as you say, Andrew, there are a lot of low cards in that deck.
Yeah.
And a lot of lion-ass hypocrites, too, because all those people who held to lock Hillary Clinton up in email jail managed to use their own personal email accounts to conduct government business.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those people, with the possible exception of Mark Meadows, turned those emails over to the National Archives in accordance with the Presidential Records Act when they got caught.
Yeah. Weirdly, I can think of at least one other person who didn't hand over those records when the feds came knocking.
Okay, fair. I mean, there's a very large asterisk on that statement, but most of them were like, okay, my bad, you got me.
Yeah.
Anyway, the archives knew Navarro was using his Proton Mail account to conduct government business because they had his correspondence with other members of the Trump administration who used their government email accounts so that those, you know, messages would be collected in accordance with the law.
Right. So we talked about this in detail in episode 707. So all of this is covered by the Presidential Records Act, 44 U.S.C. section 2201 et sec. And in 2014, as a middle finger to Hillary Clinton and teeing up, you know, lock her up for her emails, the Republican Congress added a separate provision at the end of the Presidential Records Act, specifically adding a, quote, disclosure requirement for official business conducted using non-official electronic messaging accounts. That's section 2209. And basically what it says is that executive branch employees can't use a personal email to transact government business unless they either CC their work account or they forward a copy to their official government email account within 20 days. And our pal Pete Navarro did neither of those.
No. As usual, he played this one the absolute dumbest way possible. We are, after all, talking about a guy who bought himself a contempt of Congress charge by dummying up a letter telling the January 6th committee that he had researched the law and he wasn't going to be testifying or turning over any documents so they could suck it.
Ooh, foreshadowing.
Anyway, yeah. So the archives asked him nicely in 2021 to give those messages back.
Mm-hmm.
When he ignored them. Then in June of 2022, the Justice Department sent him a slightly less nice note saying it was going to sue him if he didn't cough up.
Mm-hmm.
And he mostly ignored that one, too. He did send his earth and water lawyer, John Irving, to send a pissy letter to the archives. Yeah, no, right. We've been through this before. On July 29th, accusing the archives of being in cahoots with Democrats in Congress.
Sure.
Irving wrote, quote, yeah, no, okay. During this process, the occurrence of several events causes us to question whether Mr. Navarro's procedural due process rights may be at risk of an infringement, which is some interesting passive language. Irving said that he was saying it's not a coincidence that Congress is rattling its sabers at us and you're threatening to prosecute us and you're all in on a plot to get him. So Irving said that he'd spent considerable time searching Navarro's emails and he conceded that hundreds of government records did indeed exist on that Proton Mail account, but nonetheless, he wasn't going to hand them over without active production immunity for his client. So essentially what Irving wanted was for the DOJ to pinky swear it wouldn't prosecute Navarro if he would hand over the emails. And remember, these are encrypted, so like the government can't just subpoena the phone company. He's got to unlock them.
Right, right. And so the government spent a couple months laughing, and then in August, they filed a writ of replevin in federal court in D.C., which, of course, I love, right? So you let me do a deep dive on replevin actions back in March, and it is basically a motion to give us our shit back, right? And because this case was so stupid, the government more or less immediately moved for summary judgment. And then in October, Navarro responded with this just bizarre motion insisting that the Presidential Records Act is unenforceable, and he made a bunch of terrible legal arguments about the Fifth Amendment right to not produce government documents, and you skewered that at Above the Law in a hilarious post entitled, Peter Navarro says he doesn't have to give back stolen docs because it would make him look super guilty.
I mean, it did. It did make him look super guilty. Look, his argument was basically, I stole your shit and I've admitted it, but if I give it back, I might get arrested. So the court should just let me keep it, okay?
Yeah.
And that is not an argument worthy of Navarro's current lawyer, Stan Brand, a longtime D.C. attorney with a heretofore good reputation, and his partner, Stanley Woodward. You know, this is bullshit. But yeah, these guys have currently taken up residence in the dining car on the Trump-packed gravy train. They represent Trump's comms lackey, Dan Scavino. They represent that aide, Walt Nauta, who's you're going to hear a bunch about, I predict, because he's the one that moved the boxes in and out of the storage locker at Mar-a-Lago. They represent the self-styled declassification expert, Kash Patel. He's the one that you're probably going to hear about him, too, since he keeps saying that Trump declassified all those documents with his mind.
Yeah.
And
Is there anything Kash Patel can't do?
Yeah. And Woodward and Brand also represented Kelly Meggs, who was one of the Oath Keepers sentenced last week to 12 years for seditious conspiracy in the January 6th attack. So they're getting around.
Yeah. Not doing a lot of winning, though.
No, they're not. But who knows? You know, the night is young. Anyway, the arguments that they put forward for Navarro, in this case, were just dog shit, and they wildly misconstrued the case law, as the court later agreed. You know, like, it wasn't just me. You don't have to take my word for it. but they were pretty cheesed that I pointed it out, and they're still salty about it. But we can put a pin in that for
yes,
a second.
Yes, they are. I love this.
Yes,
I'm
they
sorry.
Are.
Keep
anyway,
going,
whatever. Okay, so in March, Judge Colleen Collar-Catelli granted the motion for summary judgment and told Navarro to give the government back its stuff. Mm-hmm. But Navarro has been doing not that for 3 months now, eliciting a series of ever more ominous warnings from the judge that she is pissed.
Yeah.
The first was after she had granted that motion for summary judgment. Navarro filed a request to stay that order of production pending appeal. And the court... That was how the court figured out that he hadn't complied with her order and handed the stuff over. So Judge Collar-Catelli wrote, the court briefly notes that on March 9th, 2023, it ordered defendant to comply with the court's order to produce a category of documents forthwith. Forthwith means immediately, without delay. Forthwith, Black's Law Dictionary, 9th edition, 2009. It would appear that defendant did not comply with that portion of the order to produce some of the documents forthwith prior to filing for a stay. Which
Ouch.
Is like, you know, that's like the fins in the water. You know shit's going to get bad. And then in April, Judge Collar-Catelli wrote another minute order saying, quote, defendant shall produce to plaintiff the already identified 200 to 250 presidential records in his possession on or before April 14th, 2023. Additionally, defendant shall complete all searches for presidential records on or before May 8th, 2023, and the parties shall file another joint status report on or before May 15th, 2023, proposing a schedule and deadline setting forth the timing and manner by which defendant will produce the remaining presidential records in his possession. Okay, so Andrew, do you think Peter Navarro complied with that second order?
Well, let's see. He's already been slapped once. That's super clear and straightforward. And I'm having a good day and I'm excited. I'm optimistic. So who am I kidding? Still no.
Yeah, no. The government does not appear to think that he complied without order because it filed a status report on May 15th suggesting that Navarro is now playing dumb with his searches. It's a bit of a long quote, but it's so mean I'm going to read it all. He said, based on the information provided by defendant's counsel, it appears that, contrary to the process agreed to by the parties, defendant has conducted a single search for emails exchanged between the Proton Mail account identified in the complaint and email addresses ending in .gov or .mil. Defendant had to know that this search was under-inclusive as his own document production included a substantial number of PRA communications for which neither the sender nor the government had a .mil or .gov email domain.
Yeah, and let me just kind of cut in because it took me a little bit to sort of figure this one out. Essentially, all of these guys occasionally used or frequently used, we don't know, but used more than once their personal emails to generate government documents to generate presidential records. And so what Navarro certified and signed off was, I searched this email account for any email that had a .gov or .mil extension on the end of it. But what the court is saying and what the government is saying is, right, but we already know that plenty of people used peter.navarro at protonmail.com, and that's not going to show up on one of those searches, and you're just playing dumb about this. You know better. You did this yourself.
Right, right, because yeah. He wasn't the only one doing it. So if he's corresponding with jared.kushner at gmail.com or whatever it is, right, it's not going to show up with a .mil or a .gov. Okay, we're clear. The government goes on. Navarro also fails to comply with the search procedures set out in the party's joint status report, which explicitly contemplated additional searches. Moreover, defendant's document production revealed that defendant used at least 4 personal email accounts to conduct official business, which is, well, he's an overachiever. However, defendant has offered no indication that each of these email accounts has been searched. To the contrary, when plaintiff reached out last week raising these various concerns and seeking additional information about the nature and extent of defendant's searches, defendant expressly refused to provide such information. Instead, defendant insisted that it was plaintiff's obligation to propose searches despite defendant's earlier commitment to search all email and his acknowledgement that any searches proposed by plaintiff were preliminary and non-exclusive.
Okay. You know, like, if you really want to piss off a federal judge, do that thing that you just described, right? Like, drag your feet about complying with the order for months on end, play coy about what it is that you're supposed to do, and for cherry on top, right, like, affect indignance that anyone would suggest that you haven't acted in good faith. Oh, and one more thing, for good measure, complain when you get called out on your duplicity, which Navarro is still doing, and put a pin in that one.
Right. So on May 19th, Judge Colicatelli put out yet another order saying, quote, suffice it to say, defendant has clearly not completed all searches for presidential records on or before May 8th, 2023, which was as required by the court order. The judgment clearly encompasses all communications on defendant's personal accounts related to defendant's official duties, not merely those addressed to or received from an email address ending in .mil or .gov. She also cleared her throat very loudly about what might happen if he does not comply.
Yeah, and this one is the kind of veiled threat that, you know, if you're a practitioner, you know what it means when you see this in a minute order. So she writes, further failure to adhere to the judgment entered in this case and the court's orders effectuating that judgment may result in a show cause order. And we'll learn more about this during our second story, where there are 3 of these. But like, a show cause order is the predicate to the court imposing sanctions pursuant to its own inherent powers to force you to comply with its orders, right? Like, it gives you one more chance to show good cause for why you're not complying with the orders. And generally speaking, it thinks you're not likely to do that.
Right. And Stan Brand and Stan Woodward have been around long enough that they know exactly what the judge means here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Judge Colicatelli told Navarro to kick up every presidential record by May 25th and file a certificate of compliance on Friday the 26th. And he, you know, he definitely did that second thing, although he appears to have filed it on the 27th.
Yeah, you know, on the scale of Navarro's sins, right, like blowing off the court's deadline by a day and a half is more, you know, venial than mortal. But dude, if you're going to play fast and loose with your own obligations, maybe don't throw shade at the government for calling you out on your deliberately under-inclusive searches. But no, in footnote 1, and spoiler alert, this is by far the least interesting of the 2 footnotes in this document. But footnote 1 has this little comment at the end, which says, Dr. Navarro would observe that despite this court's ordering the government and Dr. Navarro to submit a joint status report on or before May 15th, the government at the 11th hour, and they've capitalized 11th hour, I don't know why, elected to file a status report without the benefit of any consultation by Dr. Navarro. And that's both a lie, right? Like, you read the part from the government status report, which indicates that they tried on multiple occasions to get Navarro to conduct a real search of all of his email accounts, but he refused and was like, well, it's up to you guys to tell me what account. And it's like, no, that's not how this works, right? It's also not smart strategically to remind the court that the reason why the government couldn't file its joint status report is that your obstreperousness made it impossible to reach agreement.
Yeah.
But I digress, although put a pin in obstreperousness.
Yeah. Okay. So in this super pissy status report, Navarro complained that he's, quote, incurred tens of thousands of dollars in expenses and insisted that he doesn't know which four email accounts the government is talking about. But nonetheless, he's fully complied with his obligations and turned over all presidential records.
Okay. Because I've read a bunch on this case, and nobody else seems to think that the argument of, hey, I have no idea what email accounts you're talking about, but I promise you I've searched them, is a thing you could say to a court. Am I in the Twilight Zone? Anyway.
No, you're in Trump land. Like all lawyers in Trump's orbit, and that includes like getting paid by Trump's PAC, clearly lose their goddamn minds.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they went on in this letter. They bitched about, quote, the accusations by the court of public opinion that Dr. Navarro is overtly obstreperous. And they dropped a footnote to that article I wrote back in October about, you know, how he didn't want to hand those stuff in because it made him look guilty. I didn't even notice it. But when Marcy Wheeler flagged it on Twitter and tagged me in it, I was like, huh, I wonder which article. Because, like, there are a lot of mean articles about Peter Navarro. There's a wide universe of things that they could refer to. Anyway, but then I read it and I went back and looked at the article and I realized that his lawyers are just mad because I said their legal reasoning was garbage.
Right.
But then the court said it was garbage in exactly the same way that I said it was. So, you know, don't get sassy with me, Bernays. Also, I said yes. that his criminal defense appears to consist solely of repeating every argument rejected by Judge Carl Nichols in Steve Bannon's contempt of Congress case and hoping that Judge Mehta wouldn't notice, which is also 100% true. And I stand by that.
But you know, you're being a little modest here, right? I want you to enjoy your lifetime Article III promotion to the literal court of public opinion. Long may you reign.
Okay. Well, that's very sweet, but maybe our pal Pete is exaggerating a bit here.
Nope.
He has been known once or twice to make a category error when it comes to differentiating between public and personal. Anyway, the government has until May 31st, which is probably just about when you're listening to this show, to say whether they think Navarro complied with his obligations under the order.
Ooh. Can I take the under?
Yeah, no, I think that there's going to be competition on that side of the ticket. Anyway, as to the criminal case before Judge Mehta, remember that's the contempt of Congress, it was supposed to have gone to trial already, but Trump boned it by sending a letter saying that he retroactively invoked privilege for Navarro, and then, like, so both the parties had to brief that nonsense. The DOJ filed a motion last week to get a trial date back on the calendar, and since most of those big January 6th trials are concluding, the D.C. docket should be marginally less overwhelmed, so maybe they'll be able to get it back in. Hopefully, Woodward and Brand can do as good a job for Navarro as they did for Meggs. Anyway, and P.S., the D.C. Circuit refused to stay production. You know, remember Navarro ran to them and said, like, help me, I don't want to give this up. And it set a briefing schedule for July and August, by which point the entire issue will be moot because either Navarro will have complied with the production order or Judge Collar Catelli will have sent him to Gitmo for being so obstreperous in the court of public opinion. But like we told you in 707, this case matters because the D.C. Circuit is firmly saying, yes, the Presidential Records Act is a thing. And yes, the government has the right to enforce it, which is the exact opposite of what Trump and his goons have been arguing for a year now. So let's give a two big MAGA thumbs up to this one.
This verdict is written on a cocktail napkin and it still says guilty. And guilty is spelled wrong.
All right, guys, for our second story, we're going to look at this case of Mata versus Avianca, which is an ordinary personal injury case filed in state court in New York about a guy, Roberto Mata, that's the plaintiff, who was bumped with a drinks cart or something while on Avianca Flight 670 from El Salvador to JFK Airport in New York several years ago. Mata hired a lawyer named Steven Schwartz of the firm Levedow, Levedow & Oberman, who filed in state court in New York 2.5 years later. But as it turns out, injuries on international flights are subject to a treaty called the Montreal Convention. And Article 35 of that treaty says that you have to bring your claims within 2 years. Also, Avianca declared bankruptcy before the complaint was filed, so they would stay any claims even if they weren't barred by the statute of limitations. But, okay, Avianca removed the case to federal court, moved to dismiss on statute of limitations grounds. End of, right?
Yeah. And so if you're thinking, well, that doesn't sound like opening arguments material. Well, This is no ordinary personal injury case. This is, in fact, the lawyer using ChatGPT story that maybe you've heard about if you know you have a connection to that thing called the internet. And, and let me say this right away. I think almost everything you've likely read about this case is wrong and is playing into the hands of these lawyers who, to me anyway, looks like are trying to get away with committing out and out multiple frauds on the court. So, look, this story is definitely funny, but
it is.
There are real consequences. So, okay.
That's not going to stop me from laughing my ass off at this.
Oh, I know
it's a serious thing. And also, come on, buddy.
Yeah. So let's pick up where you left off. Avianca files its motion to dismiss, and then the plaintiff filed its opposition, right? And in that opposition, Mata's lawyers, basically they made two arguments, right? The first argument was that the New York State statute of limitations, which is 3 years, should apply rather than the federal treaties, 2 years, right? And they would be timely under that. And second, in the alternative, that by filing bankruptcy, that would toll the statute of limitations for purposes of any claims filed under the Montreal Convention. And let me say this, because this is really, really important to understand why I think they're lying about the ChatGPT stuff. Those arguments in a vacuum are perfectly sensible arguments that good lawyers would make, right? It would be puzzling and odd that there would be case law supporting either of those arguments, right? Like, because a state statute of limitations, I can't think of any example where a state statute of limitations would trump a federal statute or an international treaty, right? Like, the whole purpose of federalizing the law or having a treaty is to standardize cases, right? To say everything that comes up under the Montreal Convention is decided in 2 years, not, well, no, look, they managed to file in Idaho and Idaho has a 12-year statute. No, like, that's why you make it a federal law or a treaty, right? It would be weird, but okay, maybe they've got that. And then same thing with the using bankruptcy to automatically stay the statute of limitations so that you could then file a case. Like, that's kind of the opposite of the way the bankruptcy automatic stay. But whatever, right? If the cases say that, the cases say that.
Right. So foreshadowing, what you're saying as a practitioner is that the first thing any law firm who got this opposition would do is download all of the cases cited off of Westlaw and read them to try and figure out why they reached this counterintuitive result. Mm-hmm. Particularly if you're a firm that, like, this is a boutique fancy law firm in New York with its offices smack in the middle of Times Square. It's, you know, it's got a lot of associates. It's fancy firm. They're going to go to Westlaw. I guarantee you they have a Westlaw subscription.
Yeah. And I'm going to emphasize, you don't have to be a fancy boutique law firm with $1 million-a-year offices in Times Square. Like, any lawyer would do that when you get a pleading, right? Like, downloading all the cases cited in the brief that you're responding to figure out what the other side is. All right. Like, that's just what you do. And this is where everything starts to go off the rails, right?
Because <boy. laughs>
I immediately had flashbacks to being a first-year associate, right? Like, because, right, that's what you get assigned to do, right? Like, they don't trust you to do any other thing. So they're like, hey, your senior partner calls you up and is like, Andrew, go pull all the cases in this brief, have it to me in an hour, and be prepared to talk to me about their major case, right? And then that poor first year from Condon and Forsyth sat down, started typing these citations into Westlaw, and got nothing. I got, like, literally occasionally got unrelated cases or, you know, more nothing. And then he had to pack those unrelated cases in a little manila folder, go up the stairs, knock on the door of the senior partner's office and say, I can't find the cases. And then 100%. Okay, look, I know how coat factory law works, right? Like, that associate got screamed at, right? Got called lazy and stupid. How could you get through law school without learning how to use Westlaw, you idiot, right? But eventually, that poor associate found the temerity to be like, I understand, right? But come over here. Will you try it yourself? And the guy was like, yeah, right. And they said, and then that led to perhaps the greatest reply brief in the history of Western civilization. Liz, you want to read a little bit from it to set things up?
But of course, it says, in support of his position that the bankruptcy code tolls the 2-year limitations period, plaintiff cites to Varghese v. China Southern Airlines Company Limited, 925 F3rd 1339, 11th Circuit 2019. The undersigned has not been able to locate this case by caption or citation, nor any case bearing any resemblance to it. Plaintiff offers lengthy quotations purportedly from the, quote, Varghese case, including, quote, we, that is the 11th Circuit, have previously held that the automatic stay provisions of the bankruptcy code may toll the statute of limitations under the Warsaw Convention, which is the precursor to the Montreal Convention. We see no reason why the same rule should not apply under the Montreal Convention. The undersigned has not been able to locate this quotation, nor anything like it in any case. The quotation purports to cite to, quote, Zicherman v. Korean Airlines Company Limited, 516 F3rd 1237 1254, 11th Circuit 2008. The undersigned has not been able to locate this case, although there was a Supreme Court case captioned Zicherman v. Korean Airlines Company Limited. That case was decided in 1996. It originated in the Southern District of New York and was appealed to the Second Circuit and did not address the limitations period set forth in the Warsaw Convention. So it goes on in this vein for several pages, and this is only a 5.5 page brief.
Right.
But yeah, all of the cases cited by the plaintiff's lawyers in their opposition are, you know, let's put it neutrally, not capable of being found. So the super expensive coat factory lawyers couldn't find them, and neither could the judge's clerks.
Yep. And so because we're going to piece this together, like for timeline purposes, let me just kind of cut it and say that brief that you're talking about and the response, the motion to dismiss, the opposition, the reply, they were all filed in March of 2023. So that's going to become important as we try and figure out, you know, who lied when.
Right. And that led to the first of the court's show cause orders on April 11th, 2023, which directed the plaintiff's lawyer, now identified as a different lawyer from Levitow, Levitow and Oberman, named Peter LaDuca, to produce copies of those nine cases, which no one could seem to find. And he needed to cough them up within a week or else the court was going to dismiss the case. And then Peter LaDuca asked for an extra week because he was on vacation, which seems suspicious. But OK, fine. The court granted it.
Yeah. And suspicious is dramatic understatement, right? Like this is seriously, like this is a test that should take you an hour tops, right? Like it does not matter if you're on vacation. Let me put it this way. It took Pete longer to file the motion for extension of time than it would have to pull nine cases, right? If those cases exist.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. All right. Court was like, fine, dude, you take your vacation. You get 2 weeks, right? And so then takes the full 2 weeks, full 14 days on April 25th, files an affidavit attaching eight of those cases, says he can't find the ninth one. We are linking all of these pleadings in the show notes because if you don't go to openargs.com and click on the show notes or click on them on your phone, please do so in this case because we put a lot of work into it, but these are hysterical. You will be sad if you miss them. All right. So let's go back to our timeline. You get the March brief, and now this is an April affidavit. And now this affidavit is, in a legal sense, weird, but not nearly as weird as the cases that are attached to it. So let's talk about both, right? So first, we're going to talk about the text of the affidavit, which, again, signed under penalties of perjury. That may prove to be slightly important in the next couple of minutes. So paragraph four of Pete's affidavit says that for six of the eight cases that he attached, the stuff that he attached, quote, and I swear to you, this is word for word what he wrote, may not be inclusive of the entire opinions, but only what it made available by online database, end of real quote, which is kind of weird language, even for a lawyer, right? Like it's like translated
especially for a lawyer.
Yeah, like from ancient Autobot into Swahili by, you know, Google Translate and then back into English. But we don't say make available by online database, right? We say print from Lexis or Westlaw. All right. So first he says not make available by online database. And then remember that all of these citations are to actual books, right? So take the case that Pete says he couldn't find Zitterman versus Korean Airlines. That citation is 516 F3rd 1237. So that's the Federal Reporter, right? The third edition. You go to book number 516. You can pull it off the shelf and screenshot page 1237 on your phone. And I know, right? Lawyers don't keep hard copies. But like, you got a local law library. Like, hop in the car, drive down there, pull the book off the shelf, take a screenshot.
Well, that's not what he did.
No.
Let's talk about what Pete did attach to that affidavit. Mm-hmm. Two of the cases are real cases. Ehrlich v. American Airlines and In Re Air Crash Disaster. They just don't stand for the propositions for which they were cited in Pete's brief, which is unfortunate. It's more unfortunate, though, what happened with the other six cases, which were the subject of a disclaimer in paragraph four, which you mentioned, Andrew. And let's dive into the first one, Verghese.
Yeah.
And you're going to bet we're going to link to these. So right away, you'll see that case looks weird. It's physically off-center on the page. And on page one, there's a down arrow graphic. And as you scroll through it, like spacing changes. It's, you know, goes back to single and double space. And it looks like it was written on a cocktail napkin. And like guilty is misspelled.
Yeah. And so, okay, it's formatted weird. And then you read the case and you notice a few more things. So first you note, right, because it's an 11th Circuit opinion, that gets a three-judge panel, as all opening arguments listeners know. And the case says it was assigned to judges Jordan, Rosenbaum, and Higginbotham. Now, judges Adalberto Jordan and Robin Rosenbaum are, in fact, 11th Circuit judges. But Patrick Higginbotham, on the other hand, is a retired Fifth Circuit judge appointed by Ronald Reagan to the bench in 1982. No human being would have made a mistake like this, right?
No.
Paragraph one describes the plaintiff as the personal representative of the estate of George Scaria Verghese, deceased, right? And that would make sense, right? It's an airline crash case. So, you know, his surviving widow brings the case on behalf of George's, on George's behalf on the estate. However, in paragraph two, which is labeled factual background, his name just changes to Anish Verghese for no reason we can ascertain.
I mean, apart from all the other crazy shit about this case, you know, airline crashes are not that common. You're not going to fake a case about an airline crash that had like multiple fatalities and people aren't going to notice that it was fake. I mean, apart from everything else, it's just a little detail.
There's a lot here that I'm confused as to how they thought they were going to fake this. Right? Okay. And then this entire Verghese decision is just over 4 pages long, which you may recognize as really damn short for an 11th Circuit opinion, right?
Outer limits of what ChatGPT will
yeah, interesting, right? And it just kind of strings together some legal sounding reasoning. But if you look at it for even a minute, right? Like what I said to you on the phone last night was there are Nigerian spam scam documents that look more legitimate than this. Like no lawyer could think this was a real case. It does not have, for example, an explicit holding section, right? Like the opinion just says, appellants argue that the district court erred. We agree. And then it cites another case, the Zitterman case that also turns out to be a makeup, and then ends, right? Like real 11th Circuit cases then say, in view of the foregoing, and then, you know, end with, we are remanding back to the district, you know, we're reversing and remanding back to the district court with instructions to rule in light of this court's opinion, right? Like, the court tells the lower court what to do, that this doesn't do that. And
well, that seems kind of fake.
Yeah, it kind of does. And look, read them. We will cite them. They're all like that, right? So, yes. The lawyers use that extra week to dummy up a bunch of cases. That's clearly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
It gets better. Okay, so these are all submitted. It has attachments to Pete's affidavit filed on April 25th. The very next day, April 26th, defense counsel submits a letter to the court very politely. And I mean it. Like, this is as polite as anybody could be when the other side is just making cases up, right? Pointing out that the cases were bogus, right? And as an example of the polite, like, I love the way they've written this at the end. Like, you're a practitioner. Like, learn from this, right? Where they look at the two real cases, right, that you described, and they say, defendant has always agreed that these two cases do exist, but submits that they address issues entirely unrelated to the principles for which plaintiff cited them, right, as you said. And then notes that those two real cases, quote, are the only ones submitted in a conventional format, end of quote. But right, by which they mean, you know, not in crayon on a cocktail napkin. And that
okay.
led to the court's second show cause order, which now, in addition to dismissing out the case, explicitly threatened sanctions against Pete LoDuca.
Oh, yeah. This guy's in trouble. Let's read. It's glorious.
Yeah.
The court is presented with an unprecedented circumstance. I bet. Okay. A submission filed by plaintiff's counsel in opposition to a motion to dismiss is replete with citations to non-existent cases. When the circumstance was called to the court's attention by opposing counsel, the court issued orders requiring plaintiff's counsel to provide an affidavit annexing the copies of certain judicial opinions of courts of record cited in his submission, and he has complied. Six of the submitted cases appear to be bogus judicial decisions with bogus quotes and bogus internal citations. Set forth below is an order to show cause why plaintiff's counsel ought not to be sanctioned.
Yeah, I mean, that's more uses of the word bogus than, you know, since the Bill and Ted movies. But yeah, keep going.
Yeah. So let's figure out what bogus is, because the court's going to tell us. In support of his position that there was a tolling of the statute of limitations under the Montreal Convention by reasons of a bankruptcy stay, the plaintiff's submission leads off with a decision of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, Varghese v. China Southern Airlines Limited. Now, Andrew, you said you'd go to a law library and just pick up the right volume of the Federal Reporter 3rd edition. And that's not a bad idea. But you're not a sitting federal judge, at which point you just call your colleague the clerk of the 11th Circuit. And that one didn't go well. Okay, so it reads, the clerk of the United States Courts of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, in response to this court's inquiry, has confirmed that there has been no such case before the 11th Circuit with a party named either Varghese or Varghese at any time since 2010, i.e., the commencement of that court's present electronic court filing system. He further states that the docket number appearing on the opinion furnished by plaintiff's counsel, docket number 18-13694, is for a case captioned George Cordia v. U.S. Attorney General et al. Neither Westlaw nor Lexis has the case, and the case found at 925 F3rd 1339 is yet another one entirely.
Ouch. Okay. Yeah. And then, like, even the court kind of gets bored of dunking on Pete here. It basically is like the other five seem to be fake too, Pete. So now what we're going to have is an in-person hearing on June 8th. You're going to get your ass down to court. You're going to show up in person. Oh, and by the way, before then, by May 26th, you need to file a written affidavit and response to this show cause order explaining why you shouldn't be sanctioned for citing the non-existent cases. Now, Liz, a lesser lawyer would have just given up at this point. But Pete LoDuca is not a lesser lawyer. Instead, he decided to triple down, filing an affidavit on May 25th that has catapulted this case into the stratosphere. So we have the March brief, the April affidavit, and now we have a May affidavit, all from LoDuca. In that May affidavit, Pete says, for the first time, that he just took over the case in name only from the lawyer who was really doing the work, Stephen Schwartz. And I got to tell you, like, you go back to the complaint, and Schwartz filed that original state court complaint that the airline removed to federal court. Okay, so far, story checks out, right? Then he says Schwartz couldn't be on the federal pleadings because he's only admitted in state court. He's not admitted to practice in federal court. That happens, okay? So Pete's affidavit says Schwartz did all the work, and he just signed his name to it, so none of it is Pete's fault. That's not how the ethics rules work. But
no.
But he's in way more trouble than that, so let's elide over that one. And then Pete attaches an affidavit from Stephen Schwartz as his supervising partner. And again, before I get there, I need to tell you, Pete LoDuca, I was thinking, like, this is, you know, the like, Emily Newman, like, it's my first day kind of defense. Pete LoDuca was admitted to the bar in 1985. He's been at this firm since 1996. So, you know, he's a 27-year associate. I haven't figured that one out. These are two old guys. And that's going to be important because, you know, we're about to talk about technology, and I promise you both of them think the internet is a series of tubes, right? So let's dig into Steve Schwartz's affidavit.
Schwartz says that he wrote the brief by consulting ChatGPT, which is what has gotten all the press attention. He says, in response to defendant's motion to dismiss, your affiant performed all the legal research which was included in the plaintiff's affirmation in opposition. As the use of generative artificial intelligence has evolved within law firms, your affiant consulted the artificial intelligence website ChatGPT in order to supplement the legal research performed. As an aside, it doesn't appear that there was that much legal research since every single case was fake. But never
mind. Well, there was a citation to Iqbal and Twombly in the immediately previous, right? Like, yeah, no, there was some bare bones crap that, like, they just copied from their back files. But yeah, keep going.
Sure. Okay. He goes on. It was in consultation with ChatGPT that your affiant did locate and cite the following cases, which the court has found to be non-existent. That the citations and opinions in question were provided by ChatGPT, which also provided its legal source and assured the reliability of its content, your affiant relied on the legal opinions provided to him by a source that has revealed itself to be unreliable. And then there's a bunch of apology stuff and some ostensible screenshots from ChatGPT that also look, I think the legal term is hella fake.
but that is by no means the end of the story, because in response to that, right, the third Loduca affidavit, the Schwartz affidavit, the court then filed a third show cause order the very next day that now requests an explanation for the fake citations in the March brief, which it's been asking for since April, the fake cases that were attached in Loduca's April affidavit, which it's been asking for since May. And then it adds the use of a false and fraudulent notarization in that April affidavit. And I was like, wait, what the hell? But this is what the court's own sleuthing actually found. And I'm going to use this as the show image. So look down at your phone and enjoy along with us. That first affidavit that Peter Loduca filed on April 25th, 2023. So I'm looking at the signature page. And because this is an affirmation, because it alleges facts in response, you then have to essentially affirm the pleading under penalty of perjury as well. Like it's essentially attaching your own affidavit. And it is dated April 25th, 2023. And I never really pay attention to the notary verification part of a signature page, because who in their right mind would do so? But
right,
there are a bunch of red flags that I missed when I first looked at this affidavit. So first, and most obviously, Peter Loduca's April 25th affidavit is notarized by Stephen Schwartz, the managing partner who claims to have used ChatGPT. And look, that in and of itself is bonkers. Zero partners at law firms are notaries, right? Like, it's not like he's like making $6 an hour on the side, like, you know, notarizing wills and stuff. No, firms may have administrative staff that are notaries. Like, that can be super helpful if, you know, you have enough, it's a big enough part of your practice, that sort of. Like, I have literally never met a partner at a law firm that has maintained a notary. Okay. Second, if you go to the New York State notary list and type in Schwartz's name or his registration number, right, 02SC4998539, you get no record found. Not expired, oof, not whatever, no record found. Okay, right.
I mean, if you're going to fraud, yeah, fraud big.
But why? We're going to get to that in a minute. Okay. Third, the notary put in the wrong date. Okay. So the brief is dated April 25th. 2023, but then the sworn to before me line says this 25th day of January 2023. And look, like, on the one hand, I'm a lawyer. Lawyers typo stuff all the time, but like, notaries tend to be a little picky about the thing that's their sole job, you know, like picking the right date upon which the person came in. And then fourth, and most obviously, and I the last two digits of the expiration date on the notary seal, right? It says my commission expires August 5th, 20, and then 26 is written in pen at the end of it, right? It looks to me like maybe it says 2011 underneath the pen, but who the hell knows? The point is like he wrote his own expiration date over the top of it. It's
right.
Wow. Okay. And finally, right, as you were giggling about in the middle, and I just want to make pellucidly clear for the listeners, a notary is just there, as we've explained on multiple occasions on this show, to verify that the person who said they signed a thing actually signed it at the date that they claim to have signed it, right?
Right.
Unless you're backdating a document, there is never a need to fake a notarization, no matter how evil you are, right? Like, and they weren't backdating this document. They wrote it on April 25th. They could have gone to a real notary with a real commission to just verify that Loduca signed it, and yet they faked it.
Yeah, and also, I don't think it's particularly appropriate to notarize a document of which you are the subject, right? It's like you can't notarize your own will, you know, or you can't notarize, like, your wife's will, right? If you can't notarize her signature. You're a part of the document. It's not appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the least of the problem here, right? Like, okay, I know that I'm, like, picking at hairs here. We've got some other issues.
Right, but, like, I just want to 100% clear. Like, the notary isn't saying, I agree that the stuff you've said is true. Like, all the notary is there to do is to say, yep, watch this person sign it. But there you go. And so now that leads us to the central claim that has driven the story online. And that is that Schwartz, 3 days ago, right, as the part of the affidavit that you read, said he used ChatGPT to write that March brief. And that it's really the AI's fault by screwing him, by citing a bunch of fake cases. And all of the internet is credulously reporting that, right? And it is like, oh, well, you know. And I have to tell you, I think Schwartz is lying. And I think it's not strange to think that lawyers who, you know, cited to fake cases that included fake copies of fake cases might still be lying when they get asked about those fake cases. So, I could be wrong. But here's what I think really happened. And for this, in addition to you for bringing this to my attention, I'm indebted to my son, Alex, who really knows the ChatGPT stuff, right? Like, this is, his passion. Yeah, right. So when I look at the March brief, the one that Schwartz claims was written by ChatGPT, that's the opposition to the motion to dismiss, I will tell you, there is no way this was written by an AI. And part of that is like, because it's badly written, but it's not badly written in the way that AI badly writes stuff, right? Like, it is not an amalgam of briefs distilled off the internet, not the least of which is because it's way worse than the briefs that you can find on the internet, right? Like, and so if ChatGPT were just, you know, copying over, it would have done a better job. It's written in, like, bad law school writing, right? Like, but more importantly, while you can jailbreak ChatGPT by feeding it garbage and have it spit out something that might look like this, because I asked Alex to duplicate part of it for me and he was able to do that, it wouldn't be easy. And it wouldn't be easy because ChatGPT has protocols that prevent it from lying, right? From making up cases, right? It has to, and again, I don't want to personify. It's not really an AI. It's a, you know, glorified search engine with, you know, neural networking capacity. But you have to, people who use it, like, you have to deceive it into thinking that it is not lying. If you're savvy enough with ChatGPT, you can do that. But now I need to tell you, the legal analysis section of that original opposition is about 5 pages long. Okay, it's the kind of thing that a lawyer can bang out in a couple of hours. So in other words, even if those old guy lawyers who got admitted to practice law in the 70s and 80s were secret ChatGPT savants, which I doubt, it would take way longer to fake this brief than to just write it, which is what I think they did, right? Because I see this all the time, right? Like, lawyers, sometimes you just start out writing a brief and you're like, okay, I just need cases that say X and Y, right? And here the X and Y were various claims about the Montreal Convention. So let's look at the actual opposition. Paragraph 15 says, both federal and state courts alike have continually held that the Montreal Convention does not preempt state law remedies and that plaintiffs are entitled to choose the forum in which to bring their claim. That's a real argument. And so what I think this guy did was just wrote that and then put insert case here in the brief. And then he realized there wasn't a case that says that to insert there and just made stuff up. Now, why he thought he could get away with that, I don't know, right? Like, but
no, that's crazy.
You don't know. There's no way you're not going to get caught. But look, anything else would require way more effort. And if you're going to put in actual effort, just write the damn brief, right? Like,
yeah.
There's no explanation that makes sense. So, all right. So that's the original opposition filed in March. Next on the timeline, the other side figures out that the cases are bogus, tells the court their reply brief. The court then takes a couple of weeks the first time out, and they can't find it either. Right. So it issues that first show cause order. But back then, everyone is thinking, OK, like maybe they just made 9 separate mistakes of citation. Like maybe these lawyers are just bad. Yeah. Who knows? Right.
And so I don't think anybody thought that. No. If one citation is off or two, if every citation is off, nobody thought that was like some errors. Like, no, everybody knew. I think he was caught then. I mean, that's why I agree with you. He was caught. He was caught already. He was caught months ago.
So fair, but that first show cause order did not threaten sanctions against Loduca personally, right? It just said, you got a week, attach these 9 cases because none of us can find them, or I'm going to dismiss the case, right? And heads up, Pete should have taken the latter option there, right?
Right, especially since like his client was going to lose anyway.
Right, yeah, you just take it, you go back, you need to give the client the retainer back, you know, sorry, man, eat the L at that point. But Pete stalls for a week at that point, claiming to be on vacation. And again, maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. I have no idea. But what he did was, literally 14 days later, attach those 6 bogus cases to his April affidavit. I think took that extra week to try and figure out how he was going to write 6 convincing-looking appellate opinions in 2 weeks, because that's a tough job, right? Like, you know, you could bang his motion out in a couple of hours, but like writing a fake appellate opinion, that would be hard for anybody.
I mean, yeah, you and I have some confusion here. It's hilarious. And it's also like, what the hell were you thinking? Okay, yeah. My parents are both lawyers. Somebody that my dad was friends with, that was in his law school class, got disbarred because he was faking judges' opinions. He was faking signatures on orders. It wasn't opinions. It was orders. Mm-hmm. But you know, even as you're putting your pen to the paper, and this was, you know, in the 80s,
right.
You know, as you're putting your pen down, you are already caught and you are already probably going to lose your license to practice law. You have to think he knew whether he was going to write his own fake opinions or whether he was going to get GPT to write the fake opinions. He was already caught. And I know what you're saying, like, okay, just eat the L. I don't think there was any eat the L. I think once the court has caught you committing fraud, you're f***ed either way. I'm not sure what the thought pattern was between, you know, how he got to ChatGPT. I mean, I guess I do agree with you. I know where you're going with this because we talked about it. Go ahead. You say what you think happened.
Yeah. So I think Pete or Steve at this point, like, thought, like, oh, man, how are we going to write 6 appellate opinions in 2 weeks? And I think they were like, hey, what about that ChatGPT thing that seems to be like writing stuff for people? And I think they went to a child or grandchild and said, can you get ChatGPT to, you know, write in the style of a court opinion for me? And the kid was like, yeah, that's super easy. That's what my kid said. Right. And and that's why they generated those absolute garbage opinions that think a retired Fifth Circuit judge is on the 11th Circuit and, you know, change the name of the plaintiff in midstream, because those are the kinds of mistakes that ChatGPT makes, right? Because it's just amalgamating shit together. And so, right, human fakery wouldn't do that, right? Like, if I were faking an 11th Circuit opinion, I'd open up the tab in Google that says judges of the 11th Circuit, and I would pull the names of the panel from that list. I wouldn't do what would have to, like, what you would have to do is do the exact same thing, but only take 2 names off the list and then pull the third from Reagan appointees. Like, like you're the Riddler leaving clues for Batman or something. Like, okay. And again, you know, I would not fake an 11th Circuit opinion. Neither would the worst lawyers I've ever known, right? Like, as you just described, right? Like, and you know, this is going to go very badly for them. So, those guys not only doubled down by submitting the fake opinions, but then they tripled down, right? Because the court was like, all right, explain this shit, right? And that led to the May affidavits from a couple days ago, where for the first time, Schwartz gives the ChatGPT defense. And the reason I think he's lying about it now is because, as you point out, like, you know, you put ink to paper, you're like, yeah, comeuppance is coming, right?
Yeah.
And I think they were thinking, well, incompetence is going to be better than deception, right?
Yes, that I agree with you on.
And so
I don't agree with you on the timing.
Fair.
Okay.
So I think they looked at it and said, okay, let's see if we can't position ourselves to plea bargain this down to a reprimand or a, you know, 1 year suspension or whatever, rather than being disbarred. Because if we can convince them that, you know, I'm just an old dude and I asked ChatGPT and I didn't realize it was unreliable, then, you know, maybe the court won't, you know, completely throw the book at me. But ask yourself this. If they'd use ChatGPT to write the March brief, why would you fake the cases at all? Right. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't. You would have owned up to that in the April affidavit. You would have said, oh, yeah, no, I cited to Varghese because I asked ChatGPT and it spit out Varghese. And when I went to look up, and I should have looked it up, but I was, you know, I didn't. And then the reason I thought there was a real case is because ChatGPT told me and it's wrong and I'm bad. But they didn't, because I think they hadn't invented that excuse yet, because I think they didn't think about ChatGPT until they got it to write the fake cases, at which point they were committed to a different story.
So here's how I think you and I are slightly on different pages. Mm-hmm. I think that they dummied up those opinions. They already knew they were caught. Like, there's no way they didn't know they were caught from the jump. And I think that they dummied up those opinions, but I think they dummied them up after that second show cause order, right? Because they were like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get ChatGPT to fake these opinions, which we made up and put in our brief because we were drunk or whatever. And then we're going to say that we relied on them all the time. And that makes sense, because those ChatGPT texts that they produced, where I mean, we'll link to it in the show notes, where the lawyer is like, is this Varghese a real opinion? And ChatGPT is like, oh, yes, it's really a real opinion. I believe that all of that was faked so that they could go back and say, oh, yeah, the whole time it was ChatGPT. I think you're right. I think the whole time it wasn't ChatGPT, and that they got ChatGPT to fake up these opinions so that they could say, look, we had these opinions and we thought they were real the whole time. Like, no lawyer looked at those opinions and thought they were real. That's not what any 11th Circuit opinion in any format looks like. That looks like some shit that kicked out of ChatGPT, and it's, you know, it's clearly fake. But I think you and I are in mild disagreement as to when they hatched this dumbass plot.
So fair. Look, none of this explains why they also had to dummy up the notary line.
I'm gonna give you that one.
It's so, in any event, all of our questions will be answered at the in-person show cause hearing on June 8th, mm-hmm. Right? A little over a week from now. I hope there is a dial-in line. If there is, I don't care where you are. That is a be there, will be wild.
Oh, for sure. And like, since this reanimated Law Twitter, I mean, I know that Twitter is evil and Elon Musk is evil, but Law Twitter is a delightful place to be. And Law Twitter had the best time with this. So I guarantee to you that some lawyer in New York, if there is no call-in line, will be in that courtroom and will be live tweeting for all of our, enjoyment and edification. And it's going to be awesome.
Absolutely. All right. As we teased at the outset, if you're Patreon at any level, stick around for the bonus, which involves our pal John Eastman, legal architect of the January 6th insurrection. If not, thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for supporting us. And we will see you soon.
See you guys.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Liz. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @OpenArgs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, with assistance from Teresa Gomez and Deborah Smith.
Opening Arguments is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. Copyright 2023. All rights reserved.